It's a car. An engine. That's what I heard, and now it's getting nearer. I can see it coming toward me along the road. My mouth fills with bile. Oh, my God. It's him. It must be. He can't have got me in the trailer without a car, and who else is this likely to be, really, if not him looking for me? I look again at the sharp-leafed cactus. There's no way I could tear off one of those thick, rubbery tentacles and pierce his heart with it. If I could, I would. All I can do is try to drag myself off the road, away from him. I sob as I half-roll, half-crawl, trying to hide in the dirt and gravel and rubble by the roadside. I hear a door slam.
Excuse me, lady. You okay? You need help?
Is this a dream? Because that voice didn't sound like him. I don't want to allow myself to hope. Maybe it's a dream. I don't care if it is. I like it so far. Yes.
Help, I need help. We need to get you to a hospital. Or maybe the police? No, a hospital first.
No, Swallow.
I beg your pardon?
Swallowtail. Part of me still can't believe that something good has happened. A voice in my brain whispers, this might be him in disguise, or a friend of his, sent by him.
The spa place?
I force myself to look at this man's face. He does not look too kind or suspiciously helpful. He looks a little bored and irritated and innocent, unconnected to Leon Dandy Revel. He's my best bet.
Yes, I say. Lady, I don't think you're going to be allowed in there in your condition.
I'm staying there. I lift my right arm and look at it before sliding my hand slowly into the pocket of my shorts, wondering if I can trust my memory from what seems like so long ago. Yes, it's there. I pull out the key card for my casita. It has the Swallowtail logo on it. I try to hold it up to show it to the helpful man, but my fingers won't work properly, and I drop it. Swallowtail, I say again. Please, take me to Swallowtail.
I figured something out today. Something that links back to a conversation I had with my mother years ago. Would you like a little brother or sister? She asked me one day at the breakfast table. My father was there, too. He looked surprised. I think I must have been about 4 years old at the time. Not a sister, I said quickly. Emery was my sister. Having a sister, to me, meant having a dead sister. And I already had one of those. A brother was different. I could imagine having a not-dead brother, but that would be unbearable in a different way. I would love him, and I would have to watch him suffer. Or, if my parents planned to be much kinder to him than they were to me, then he would have to watch me suffer. And, if he was anything like me, that would make him sad and scared. And not a brother, I added, once I'd thought it through.
Neither, said my mother.
Why not? I know you don't love Emery, but you might love a new sibling. This was designed to make me feel guilty. I did love Emery, or at least the idea of her. At the same time, I wondered, how can you love someone who died before you were born? I suppose some people are too selfish to love anyone but themselves, said my mother in a matter-of-fact tone. My father ate his toast and drank his coffee, looking out of the window as if nothing important was being said, nothing he needed to pay attention to. Actually, I would love a baby brother, I said. I must have felt braver than usual that morning. But I'd be afraid he'd die.
Is that so? Said my mother. Well, they say you always kill the thing you love.
She glanced at my father, who ignored her. I didn't know what she meant. Was she saying she thought I would deliberately kill my own little brother? At that moment, she seemed cut off from my father and me in a way I couldn't quite fathom. When she next spoke, her voice had a faraway sound, as if she drifted off into a private world. You know,
I don't think that's right, she said. I think it's the other way around. You love the thing you've killed. But only once it's too late. Annette, said my father in a warning tone. No more. My mother responded instantly, snapping back to her normal conversational mode. Yes, she said. What a horrible, morbid subject. Wait. Those words ran through my mind so often when I lived with my parents. Wait, that's wrong. Something's not right. I just need a chance to figure out what it is. While my mother and my father talked about plans for the day ahead, I silently replayed what I'd heard. Her. You love the thing you've killed, but only once it's too late. Him. Annette. No more. I'd only ever known my mother to show love for one person. Emery. After she was dead. While she was alive, I wasn't around to witness anything. So I can't speak for how my mother felt about her then. I wondered if my mother had deliberately killed Emery. She'd told me Emery had died in her tummy. My father had said so too, but maybe it wasn't true. As soon as I was old enough to understand, the kind smiles told me about Mallory Tondini and showed me the famous interview she did on TV. After that, I had no choice but to believe that Emery had died in my mother's womb. In one way, it was a relief to know this, but it also confused me. I thought I understood, and clearly I was wrong. Mallory Tondini worked at the hospital and had been there when my parents had lost Emery. So if she thought it was a natural death, then it must have been. I asked the kind smiles what they thought about all this, but they didn't seem to want to talk about it. I asked if there was a way my mother could have eaten or drunk something that made Emery die inside her, without Mallory or anyone at the hospital noticing. They said they didn't think so. I couldn't work out why they looked so sad if that was true. It was obviously better if my parents hadn't killed my sister. I don't know how it took me until today to see it. I was only with the kind smiles in the first place because of what they feared my parents would do to me. My mother was talking about me, not Emery, at the breakfast table that day. She was unhappy about her inability to love me, and she knew that the only way she could manage it was if she killed me first. I think that's what she was trying to communicate to my father. You want me to love Melody? Fine. But the only way it's going to happen is if I kill her first. Loving Emery's easy. She's dead. No wonder the kind smiles felt they had no choice but to get me out of my parents' house.
Chapter 16. October 16th, 2017. Orwin pretty steeled himself as he got out of his car, seeing Bonnie Juno striding toward him across the resort parking lot. As someone who spent much of his life trying to prevent any honest expression of his thoughts or feelings from making its way into the outside world, he'd never felt comfortable around people who spoke their minds no matter what the consequences. And when that quality was coupled with a ferocious determination to get your own way at all costs, as it was in Juno.
Hey, detective! She yelled at him over the rows of cars. There you are! Where the hell have you been? Now, you'd better tell me right this second and not feed me some bullshit line. Where's Kara Burrows?
Determination was one of Pretty's qualities, too, though he was less demonstrative about it. As a result, people rarely expected him to stand his ground. Often they didn't realize that was what he was doing until a gradual awareness started to creep up on them. I asked him to do X, and he didn't say he wouldn't, so why hasn't he done it yet? It was a feature of human interaction that had interested Pretty for some time,
that unless you told the world explicitly who and what you were, I'm a kick-ass blowhard who takes no prisoners and you'd better believe it, I'm a home-loving soccer mom who's all about her kids, there was a strong chance that even those closest to you would perceive you incorrectly, or, perhaps more depressingly, not have any ideas about you at all.
Quit stalling!
Juno bellowed, her red face now nearly touching Pretty's.
Where is she?
I'm sorry if you haven't been kept in the loop.
It never did any harm to start with an apology.
Kara's safe. She's been found. Or rather, she found her way back without any help from us.
He wasn't about to claim credit for someone else's achievement.
Are you for real? You think I don't know that? Lord in heaven, please don't tell me I know more about what's going on than you do.
I don't know about that, ma'am.
I know Kara got back here yesterday, hitched a lift, got looked over by doctors, all of that.
She sustained a few minor injuries in the process of escaping, but she'll be fine. So will her baby.
What I don't know is where she is now.
Juno steamrollered on.
I can't find Detective Sanders or Dame Williamson. Agents Kirschmeyer and Turriff are treating me like I don't exist. Clearly, they never switch on their televisions.
I don't think media liaison is their priority at the moment,
said Pretty.
Having said that, I know that no one's deliberately trying to exclude you. I'm on my way to the Rutherford B. Hayes room now, a little late. I'm surprised you're not there already.
The Rutherford B. Hayes room?
Juno flinched as if he'd said something obscene. What is that?
Rutherford B. Hayes, former president of the United States.
What the hell does he have to do with anything?
Nothing. Just there's a meeting room here named after him, and that's where I'm headed now.
I see,
Juno said through gritted teeth.
So you're on your way to a cozy heads-up that no one's told me about. The feds arrive, and all of a sudden I'm out in the cold.
Not at all.
As long as Juno wasn't angling in on Kara Burroughs, Pretty was happy to reassure and placate.
Agent Kirschmeyer wants and expects you to be there. No cameras, obviously.
Why, obviously? And if Kirschmeyer wants me so much, how come no one said anything to me about any meeting? I know when people are avoiding me, and I know why. You're all terrified of hearing how wrong you are. You think Annette and Naldo Choppa can't be behind all this? You really believe that?
So she was still pushing that angle. The woman was incredible. Annette and Naldo Choppa, faking their daughter's death for 7 years in order to make sure their convictions for her murder stick. It made zero sense. Don't take the bait. She wants you to ask why they'd ever do that so she can spout more crap.
No one's avoiding you, ma'am. Come with me now and you'll see.
Pretty tried to lead the way and failed. Leaders need at least one person following them. Juno stood firm.
Wait a second. It's Kara I'm most interested in. Where is she right now?
She was with her husband in a casita that the resort reserved for important visitors. Her children were on their way over from England with their grandmother. Pretty had no intention of telling Bonnie Juno any of this. Kara Burroughs needed time alone with her family, more than she needed to help boost the ratings of, as Lynn had called it last night, distorting justice with Bonnie.
Something funny, Detective?
No, ma'am.
I need an interview with Kara on tonight's show, which means Heidi needs to prep her for it and—
No, sorry. No interviews with Kara Burroughs.
What? Are you insane? Without her, there's a gaping hole in the story.
It'll have to be filled some other way.
Detective, you are trying my patience.
Althea, Pretty's wife, described it as his superpower. The ability to say nothing and look neutral for as long as it took for his opponent to run out of steam.
I was so wrong about you!
Juno exploded.
I never had you down as a bully, but listen to you now. Without letting Kara decide for herself if she wants to talk to me, you're taking all autonomy away from her and making that choice on her behalf. How are you any better than her abductor, I'd like to know?
Mrs. Burroughs has made it clear to Agents Kirschmeyer and Turriff that she wishes to be left alone with her family.
As if the mention of his name had summoned him, Turriff appeared at that moment. He was walking purposefully toward them.
Come on,
said Pretty. This time Juno followed.
We're waiting for you both,
Turriff called over as they approached.
See?
Said Pretty.
Like I said, you're invited. No one's avoiding you.
Kara Burroughs is,
said Juno sulkily.
She has a duty here. I don't think she realizes—
There's been a development.
Turiff cut her off. He looked only at Pretty as he said,
We've got them, Leon Reville and Melody. They've been found.
Melody Choppa was drinking warm milk in the living room of a house somewhere in Phoenix. Near Phoenix, anyway. She didn't know precisely where she was, and it was making her feel funny. In the past 7 years, she'd been moved around a lot, but Dandy had always shown her each new place on a map first. She'd liked that. Maps were amazing. When she grew up, she wanted to be a cartographer. She didn't know exactly what the job involved, but it sounded serious and important, and if it meant looking at maps, she knew she'd enjoy it. The house had a white painted front, a pillared porch, and a fat garage that stuck out awkwardly at the side. Melody thought it was ugly. From what she'd managed to figure out, it belonged to the FBI, or they were allowed to use it. There was a woman in the house named Jennifer who was nice, but nobody seemed to think she was important, or at least the two agents didn't, Lynn and Jomo. Maybe this house was Jennifer's home. She hadn't asked any difficult questions yet, and it didn't seem as if she was going to. She was something to do with the FBI, too, but she was also a kind of babysitter. She looked like a grandma. She had brought a blanket, even though it was hot. Who would want a blanket? Melody hadn't wanted to be rude and say, no thanks, so she'd laid Poggy down on the tiled floor and covered him with it. Jennifer seemed to think that was an okay thing to do. She hadn't objected. The milk tasted disgusting. Melody regretted choosing it over orange juice. She'd thought she liked milk, but this was the first time she'd had it warm. What would Jennifer think if she left most of it? Melody was scared about lots of things, but the thing that frightened her most was not knowing what people were going to think about her from now on. By people, she meant strangers, and that was everyone in the world apart from a handful of people. She'd always known what Dandy thought of her since the first day she met him.
You're a brave girl, Melody, he said to her. Nothing that's happened is your fault.
He had repeated those lines many times since their first meeting, when she was 7 years old. Melody also knew what Christy and Jeff thought of her, that she was perfect and brilliant in every way. This was obviously not true, though it was sometimes nice to hear. What Melody thought and felt about all of them was harder to determine, but she'd never cared about that. Her own emotions and opinions weren't a threat to anybody, whereas those of others could definitely harm her. Like Zelly from the art group, who'd said one of Melody's paintings was cloying, whatever that meant. And like Christy, who said, I love you so much, favorite child, and much more. Melody had grown to hate the nickname over the years. It was silly, when Christy didn't seem to know any other children. And the idea of being a favorite was alarming. It was pressure, like an arm pressing down on your throat. And now there was the new pressure of knowing that the whole world was thinking things about her. Melody didn't like it at all. It was okay when everyone believed she'd been stolen away from her parents and murdered. Everyone knew what opinion to have about that. And when it was decided that her parents had killed her, Melody had known that, still, she wasn't the only one, and that was a comforting thought. Dandy had said that of all the children who were murdered, most times their own parents are guilty of the crime. Now it was all different and frightening. Soon everyone would know that Melody had pretended to be a murder victim when she wasn't. People would think she was a liar. They wouldn't understand that it wasn't like that. And worst of all, Dandy wasn't here to tell her not to worry, that it was okay because lots of other girls had also pretended to be murdered and kept up the pretense for years and years, which Melody knew they hadn't. She'd done a lot of pretending, not only to be dead, but also, as Haley, to have cancer. Would the world blame her? Or would people say she was only a child and couldn't be held responsible? Dandy would know. He was also the only person likely to give her a truthful answer. But Melody had no idea if she would ever see Dandy again.
So you've got Leon Dandy Reville, but not Jeff or Christy or Rihanna Briggs,
said Bonnie Juno. Lynn Kirschmeyer nodded. Those three are still in the wind, but the very best agents are on it here and in Philly.
The very best, huh?
Juno sounded unimpressed. Pretty wasn't surprised. She was the sort of person who recognized no one's achievements but her own.
Also present were Jomo Turiff, Bryce Sanders, Heidi Casafina, Dane Williamson, and Taryn Fry. Sanders took a sip of water from his glass.
Has Melody been asked about the book?
He directed the question to Turiff, not Lynn. He hadn't looked at her once. Pretty was watching. Turiff nodded.
Says she told the story to the kind smiles who wrote it down. That's all she'll say. Kind smiles. She won't name names, just clams up.
Leon Reville told Kara Burrows that Christy Reville did all the actual writing. Lynn says,
I'm uncomfortable with the way you're all leaping to conclusions, said Heidi Casafina. We don't know for sure that this girl's Melody.
DNA results will be a while, but it's her, said Lynn. If you're not convinced now, Ms. Casafina, you soon will be.
What's that supposed to mean?
It means shut up and listen, said Taryn Fry.
Bonnie, do you think it's her? Heidi asked. Do you think this girl is Melody?
Juno looked at Lynn Kirschmeyer.
She says she's Melody Choppa, right?
Yes, she does.
Juno shrugged. She looked dazed.
Then I believe her, I guess.
So, what's the theory?
Taryn Fry asked.
Or, to put it more bluntly, what the hell happened here?
I'd rather not speculate,
said Turiff.
Allow me, then, said Taryn. Christy Reville and Rihanna Briggs sat on the Benjamin Chalfont jury together in 2003. We know they were both convinced he killed his wife, but no one else was, so he got off. It's not hard to imagine what happened next. Righteous discussions about how the law's an ass, how too often it allows the guilty to walk free, meaning there's no real protection or justice for anyone. You want justice, you're going to need to get it for yourself. No one else cares. Then, years later, Christy Reville figures out she's living next door to a couple she's certain are a danger to their daughter.
Excuse me. Heidi Casafina turned to Turiff.
How long are you going to let her carry on like this, making it up as she goes along? I mean, who is she? Some florist from Kansas? Why is she here?
I have a question, too, said Bonnie Juno.
What are we all doing here around this table? Is there new information? Because if there isn't...
My time's as valuable as yours, Miss Juno, Lynn told her.
Yes, Agent Turiff and I have new information to share with you.
Then let's hear it.
The way I see it, there's a whole lot that doesn't add up, like the idea that Rihanna Briggs, if she's involved in this fraudulent plot, would send Kara Burrows to the very hotel room she reserved with her own credit card, with her name on it, to hide Melody in. Why would she self-sabotage like that?
You never heard of someone under pressure making a mistake?
Said Sanders.
A lot of mistakes seem to have been made here, Detective. Why did Leon Reville snatch Kara Burrows, can somebody tell me? What was the point? She'd already told her friend Taryn about seeing Melody, the whole story.
Leon Reville didn't know that, maybe,
said Pretty.
As the only person here who knows Rihanna well, I can't believe she's involved in anything illegal,
said Dane Williamson.
Because she respects the law?
Taryn Fry rolled her eyes.
Trouble is, after seeing wife murderer Chalfont walk free, she thinks no one else does. No one but her and Christy Reville. It's clear they felt they had no choice. How is that clear?
Heidi Casafina threw up her hands.
You're just making things up. Nothing is clear.
What's Leon Reville saying so far?
Pretty asked Lynn. Read the book, she said.
I don't have it.
No, that's what he's saying. It's all he's saying. Just keeps repeating it. Read the book. It's all in the book.
Is this your brilliant new intel?
Bonnie Juno sneered.
Leon Dandy Reville telling us all to read a book?
He's not telling you anything. Lynn took the sting out of her words with a broad smile. Juno still looked stung. And no, that is not the information we want to share with you. Agent Turiff? Turiff took his cue and stood up.
Before she left the trailer, Kara Burrows sent a message to her daughter using Instagram.
He said,
as follows. I'm in trailer, don't know where, 2 hours, open parenthesis, guess, close parenthesis, from Swallowtail. Tell police, interview Jeff Reville colleague again, Ray M. Bloody Sock in car. Car seat move forward, did Christy? And then the letters, M-O.
M-O? Said Taryn Fry. As in modus operandi?
No, as in the first two letters of the word move. If Mrs. Burrows hadn't feared that Leon Reville might come back any second and deprive her of her escape opportunity, she'd have completed that sentence. Having spoken to her, I can confirm what it would have been. Did Christy move the car seat back again before she drove away?
I'm totally lost.
Heidi Cassafina sighed heavily.
Could not be more confused.
How about you, Bonnie? Lynn asked her.
I'm following,
said Juno with a nod.
I think I know where you're going. Let me explain,
said Turiff.
When Mrs. Burroughs arrived in Phoenix, she rented a car, a Range Rover. It had a feature she'd never encountered before. Memory buttons numbered 1 to 4 so that 4 different driving positions can be stored. You want to drive the car after your spouse has driven it, just press button M2. The seat automatically adjusts to your most comfortable driving position. Next time spouse gets in, she presses M1. Seat goes back to her ideal setting. Is your wife's first name spouse, Agent Turiff?
Sanders chuckled to himself. Everybody ignored him.
The day Melody Choppa went missing, Jeff Reville's colleague, Nate Appleyard, saw her blood-stained sock in Christy Reville's car.
Turiff went on.
Jeff and Christy Reville were in the car talking. Appleyard approached them. Christy was visibly shocked and looked like she'd been crying. Appleyard saw the stained sock on the floor of the car. He stated very clearly the sock was positioned about 3 centimeters in front of Christy Reville's foot. That means, obviously, that Christy's foot was easily visible. That means nowhere near the gas pedal. When you've got your foot on the gas, someone standing outside the car couldn't see 3 centimeters in front of it.
True, said Heidi Cassafina. But I still don't see...
Christy Reville is only 5 feet 2 inches tall,
said Turiff.
She's a short lady. Nate Appleyard said that, shocked by his sudden appearance and knowing he'd seen the sock, Christy moved her car seat forward to cover it up. And then, he told police, she drove away.
So what?
Sanders shrugged.
I don't see the significance.
I'll explain, Detective Sanders, Lynn said smoothly. Leon Reville showed Kara Burroughs a YouTube video while she was in the trailer. In it, Christy Reville was standing on a stage. Kara saw how short she was. That's when she remembered what she'd read online about Nate Appleyard and the sock. She thought about driving postures, how different people position the driver's seat differently. Thanks to the 4 memory buttons on her rental car, this was fresh in her mind. She started to wonder. Christy Reville moved her seat forward to hide the sock from Appleyard, and then she drove off. That's what Appleyard told police. That means, doesn't it, that after moving her seat forward, her feet reached the pedals. She wasn't too far forward to drive comfortably. Appleyard didn't see her move the seat back again before she drove off.
Which means?
Turiff took over.
That before Appleyard crept up on her, Christy Reville must have pushed her seat right back to where she couldn't reach the gas pedal or the brake, back to 3 centimeters behind where the blood-stained sock lay. Only why would she do that? Who does that? Who parks and then pushes their seat right back?
You've got to be kidding me, said Heidi. Anyone who wants to stretch their legs after a long drive, that's who. I've done it myself, I'm sure.
I'm with Heidi,
said Sanders.
Maybe,
Turiff conceded.
Another hypothesis is that someone who wasn't Christy drove the car last, parked it in the parking lot of the school where Jeff Reville worked, then got out, retrieved her own car, and drove away. This someone would have been a much taller person than Christy.
Taller than Rihanna Briggs, too, thought Pretty. Jeff Reville was pretty tall, but he'd never learned to drive. His cousin Leon was, like Pretty, on the small side for a man. From Heidi's face, it was clear she hadn't figured out yet who this possible tall driver might be. But then, Pretty thought, why would she? She still didn't know about the Chalfant trial.
This is insane, she said.
No, it's logical, Lynn corrected her. Kara Burroughs thought of it, and so did Detective Pretty here when he read Kara's Instagram message to her daughter. You see, he'd just made his own exciting discovery. She stopped to take a sip from her bottle of orange juice. He'd found out that the trial had brought Christy Reville and Rihanna Briggs together. Benjamin Chalfant's murder trial had also brought them into contact with someone else, someone with much longer legs than Christy Reville's.
Christy Reville and Rihanna Briggs thought it was an outrage that Chalfant walked out of that courtroom a free man, but they were only jurors,
said Turiff.
Imagine how the lead prosecutor must have felt.
That was the moment when Heidi's expression changed. The brief silence in the room was the heaviest Pretty had ever known. I think you know who we're talking about now, Heidi. Lynn said with quiet authority. A former prosecutor from Philadelphia, who gave it up to become a TV show host. Heidi's face had lost all its color. She turned to her boss.
Bonnie, what's going on?
Bonnie Juno,
said Turiff.
Correct. That's who prosecuted Benjamin Chalfant. That's who decided, years later, along with Christy Reville and Rihanna Briggs, that sometimes, if you want to save an innocent life, you have to take the law and justice into your own hands. Isn't that right, Ms. Juno? And we get there at last, said Juno with a smile. Anything else you want to say, Bonnie? Lynn asked her. Or shall we save it and do it live on tonight's edition of your show?
Bonnie, tell them it's not true.
Heidi had started to cry.
What are they accusing you of? I don't understand.
Turiff said, Miss Juno, before you decide how you want to respond, bear in mind we still have the DNA samples from Christy Reville's car back in 2010. Don't worry. Juno waved her hand in the air. I'm no fool. When it's over, right? I gave it my best shot, and I failed. It happens. But you still need something from me. Something more than an admission. You want to know where Jeff and Christy are, where Rihanna is. There's only one way you're ever going to find out, and that's if I tell you. So?
She raised her eyebrows, a challenge to Turiff and Lynn. The live on your show tonight offer wasn't serious, Lynn told her.
Oh, that's not what I want. It's hardly my show now, is it? Not anymore. Heidi, you take it over. Change the name, distance yourself from me, make the show your own. I'll give you exclusive access to the story, the true story, of what happened to Melody Choppa.
For a second, Heidi looked happy. Dazed, startled, but also kind of ecstatic. Then she shook her head violently and scrunched up her face, as if she'd just realized that this great offer from her boss was some kind of punishment in disguise.
I can't do it, she said. I have to... No, I can't. After what you've done, I can't.
Yes, you can, Heidi, said Bonnie Juno firmly. Agent Kirschmeier, what I want isn't something for myself.
Let me guess, said Lynn. The starving orphans in Africa? The refugee children from Syria?
We all know philanthropy is what you're all about, Bonnie. Philanthropic child abduction in particular. I'm going to need a cast-iron guarantee that Melody won't be sent to live with her parents once they're out of jail, said Juno. A fully binding guarantee checked out by my legal team so I know you're not trying to cheat me. Give me that, and then I'll tell you what you want to know.
Chapter 17, October 23rd, 2017.
Mum, did Taryn Fry say you should divorce Dad? Jess asks as we drive along a road that looks as if it's made of hard-baked pink sand. We're on our way to the Clearwater Resort and Spa in Sedona, 2 hours from Paradise Valley.
Did she?
Ollie asks his sister, sounding confused, as he often does when he's been absorbed in a game on his phone and missed a whole chunk of conversation.
Don't divorce Dad, Mum. It's none of Taryn Fry's business. But if you do, I'm living with Dad. He plays football with me. You always make excuses.
Yeah, but in Mum's favour, she actually listens when you speak to her, says Jess. Dad does that old person thing where he can't listen and do something on his phone or computer at the same time. So you ask him, like, shouldn't we be setting off to school now? And he doesn't answer for 10 seconds, and then he's like, I think it's in the fridge.
Yeah, Ollie laughs. Hashtag senile2k17.
Taryn didn't tell me to divorce Dad, I say. And she's the last person I'd take life advice from. She's married to someone she can't bear to go on holiday with. I know Jess won't leave it there. A few minutes later she says, But you said Taryn was glad you left Dad once, so why wouldn't she try to make you do it again? Taryn can't make me do anything, love. She's not the Wicked Witch of the West.
Are we sure about that? Patrick mutters, trying to make me send an email to myself saying, Help, I've been kidnapped, love, Kara.
He makes a noise of disgust. She wanted me to tell you she'll never forgive you for not sending it, I smile.
She'd have landed me in an Arizona jail if I'd listened to her.
Who's the Wicked Witch of the West? Ollie asks. Never mind, Ol. Mentally, I add to an ever-growing list. Must make sure new baby watches The Wizard of Oz and Annie and E.T. and all the classics I love, or the movies Jess and Ollie refuse to watch because they look old and lame. Maybe I'll build a wall between the part of the house where the baby hangs out and the part where Jess and Ollie live. If I don't, the baby will be mocking Patrick and me by the time he or she is 6 months old. I feel guilty as soon as the thought has passed through my mind.
It's a sort of joke I used to make without thinking, the kind I'll never now be able to make without a hollow feeling plunging through my stomach. I take it back. No walls, no oceans, no barriers, no unspoken conflict separating any of us ever again. I'm nervous about letting Patrick or the kids out of my sight. My biggest anxiety about this trip we're setting off on now is that, for a period of time, I will have to be in a room that doesn't contain my husband and children. I've made Patrick promise to keep a keen eye on Ollie and Jess every second I'm not there to do it myself. Taryn's amazing, I say, wanting to stick up for her despite her low opinion of my husband. Does that make me disloyal? I don't think so. Yes, Patrick is flawed and can be inconsiderate, but so am I. So can I. As much as it hurts my pride to admit it, I have to face the fact that finding out about the new baby caused both me and Patrick to behave badly. Not just badly, appallingly. His failure to ask me how I felt was matched by my inability to say, "You've really hurt me and pissed me off, and we need to talk about that." To take a chunk of our savings and disappear instead, scaring my children out of their wits, undermining the certainty they've always had that our family's a safe place. That was unforgivable unless we all decide to forgive each other. That, I'm starting to think, is what loyalty means. Not pretending those close to us are perfect, but ceaselessly loving and devoting your life to people you know are severely flawed. Because you don't expect them not to be. You adore them anyway. From now on, I'll think about what's wrong with my own character every time I find myself dwelling on one of Patrick's faults, or Jess's, or Ollie's. Whenever my guilt about what I did gets too intense, I'll remember the wise words of another deeply flawed person, Taryn, and they'll make me feel better. 3 days after I escaped from the trailer, she took me for lunch at a hotel called the Biltmore and gave me a pep talk. "Kara, I cannot tell you how pissed at you I'm going to be if you take away the wrong moral from this story. I mean it. None of the bad stuff that's happened to anybody happened because you needed a break and treated yourself to a stay at Guacamole HQ. You blew Bonnie Juno's plot wide open by sheer chance, and it's great that you did. It does not, in any way, mean no woman should ever leave her irritating husband at home and head for a 5-star hotel. And if I ever hear you try to spin it that way, I will freak out, I swear. I do it at least once a year. Irritating husband, left at home. And I've never stumbled across a murder victim who's not dead. So that proves it. In my favor." "Why is Taryn so amazing?" asks Ollie. "She suspected Bonnie Juno's involvement from the start," I tell him. "She heard her quite blatantly tell the police that she and her team would look into Rihanna Briggs' disappearance, in a way that sounded to Taryn as if she wanted to make sure no one else looked. It's funny the things that stick in your mind and become the most powerful memories. I'd struggle now to visualize the inside of Dandy's trailer, but I can still vividly picture Rihanna's distraught face when I told her she'd sent me to room 324, and there were people already in it, a man and a girl. She nearly started crying. I thought she was unusually solicitous and conscientious. Now that I know the truth, it seems so obvious. Her distress was too extreme. It was the horror of someone who's afraid they're going to land themselves and their friends in prison for a very long time, all because of a stupid, careless mistake. Even so, I can't bring myself to think of Rihanna as a bad person. When she wrote, 'Kara Burrows, is she safe?' on that piece of paper, I don't think she meant to ask if I was a risk. I think she was worried about me, and wondering if I would be safe, given what I'd seen. She feared Bonnie Juno would order Dandy to kill me, and the thought terrified her. Or maybe that's just what I'd like to think. I can't prove it."
"Mum," says Ollie.
"Yes, darling?"
"If you hadn't gone to the Swallowtail Resort and seen Melody Chopper, would Bonnie Juno have got away with it? Would Melody's parents have stayed in prison forever?"
"I don't know," I say at the same time that Patrick says,
"Probably."
"What will happen to Melody now?" asks Jess. "Where will she live? Will she have to go back to her horrible family?"
Lynn Kirchmere thinks almost certainly not. After everything Melody's been through, the courts are unlikely to send her back to abusive parents. Detective Priddy told me Melody has an aunt in Portland, Oregon. Everyone seems to think she'll probably end up living with her.
"How long will Bonnie Juno and all the people who helped her go to prison for?" Ollie asks.
"I don't know, Ol. No idea.
Are you nervous about meeting Melody for the first time?
Ollie, don't bombard Mum with questions, says Patrick.
It's not the first time, stupid, Jess says wearily. She met her in the hotel room, remember?
Yeah, and their second meeting's going to be at a different five-star resort, says Patrick. The biggest mystery in all of this, one no law enforcement official has yet explained to me, is how Melody keeps ending up in all these plush resorts. Swallowtail would have been on Bonnie Juno's tab, but who's funding this latest jaunt?
Shut up, Dad, you noob, says Jess. Trust you to think about all the boring things.
Lynn Kirchmere said they'd decided to move her well out of Phoenix, I say. I don't know why, but there must be a reason. Hiding her from the media, possibly.
I think she's a secret oligarch, says Patrick. Only willing to come back from the dead if she can get champagne and caviar delivered to her sun lounger on a silver tray.
I'm not stupid, Ollie says quietly to Jess in the back seat. The first time Mum met Melody, she didn't know who she was, and Melody was pretending to be someone else. This is the proper first time, today.
I suppose so. Then, as if realizing she's slipped up, Jess adds, But I'm still right.
Are you nervous, Mum? About meeting her? I wonder what you'll talk about. I wouldn't know what to say.
I wouldn't either. I don't.
I'm not particularly nervous.
No, I lie.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
Statement from Bonnie Juno, October 23, 2017. Dear fellow Americans, the first thing I'd like to say is that I love my country and my fellow countrymen and women. I also love the law, which has been my vocation my entire life. But there's something I love even more, and that's justice. And by that, I do not mean my show, Justice with Bonnie, though I have loved that, too, with all my heart. No, I mean justice. That shining light that all civilized people should prize higher than any other virtue. Justice that means every citizen getting what he or she deserves, and equally importantly, not getting what they don't deserve. Sometimes the law cannot or will not deliver true justice. I passionately believed that to be the case with regard to Melody Choppa and her parents, Annette and Naldo Choppa. When my friend, Christy Reville, told me about the horrors that were going on in that family, when she told me she was frightened that if we couldn't get little Melody out of that house, her parents would find a way to bring about her death, I knew I had to take action. That's why I did what I did. Figured out, along with Jeff, Christy, and Leon Reville, and with help from Brianna Briggs, a way to save Melody. Trust me when I say that the authorities, had we taken our concerns about little Melody to them, would ultimately have proved unable to perform an effective rescue operation. After listening at length to Christy's description of the behavior of her sinister next-door neighbors, I understood what subtle and brilliant monsters Annette and Naldo Choppa were. They were expert at ensuring that nothing could be proven against them. Their torture methods were ambiguous enough to guarantee they'd have gotten away with it forever if I hadn't stepped in. Christy, Rihanna, and I first met in a court of law. Together, we witnessed a terrible miscarriage of justice that we were unable, in spite of our best efforts, to prevent. We witnessed a mockery of justice that no one seemed able to recognize, apart from the three of us. We weren't willing to stand by and let another equally heinous crime take place under our noses, not if we could help it. I am prepared to face the law's punishment for what we did. I would never have disclosed the whereabouts of my associates, but I am prouder than I can express of them all for willingly coming forward almost immediately. We now stand strong together. Christy, Jeff, Leon, and Rihanna are happy, as am I, to pay the price for what we did. We judge it to be worth it. Whatever time we end up serving behind bars. It will be worth it, because, quite simply, we succeeded in saving Melody Choppa's life. Her parents, far from being delighted to discover their daughter is alive after all these years, have disowned her for a book she wrote while she was in hiding and what that book reveals about their true characters. I think that fact alone speaks volumes. I might not be able to present my show anymore, but I am still the legal geek I've always been, and I hate loose ends as much as I ever have. So I'd like to share with you a few answers to the questions I would ask if I were the American public. Were we planning to kill Kara Burroughs? Absolutely not. As soon as it was safe to release her, after Melody's plastic surgery, she'd have been free to go. She might have been able to lead the police and the FBI to Leon Reville, but never to Melody. I'd have made very sure of that. And that was all any of us cared about. Melody's safety, Melody's future. What exactly was the plan made by myself and my fellow justice seekers? This question has been fairly thoroughly answered by Jeff Reville already, but I want to give my version. On March 2, 2010, Christy took Melody to her school. I had arranged to be in Philadelphia at the agreed time, and I also drove to the school parking lot that day in a car I'd rented under a false name. When the parking lot was empty, Christy and I swapped cars. She drove mine to Victor Sutar's home. I drove hers, with Melody in it, to where I'd agreed to meet Leon Reville. He took over Melody's care at that point. We hadn't told Melody the plan. That was hard, explaining it all to her later on. Little children usually love their parents, however terrible those parents may be. We did everything we could to reassure and comfort Melody. Indeed, the only reason I drove Christy's car that day and she drove mine was because we knew Melody felt so perfectly at home in Christy's battered old Toyota. Christy and I had arranged to meet later that day in the parking lot of a different school, the one where Jeff Reville worked. At that point, we swapped our cars back. I left the driver's seat in the tall person driving position that has been much commented on in the media, and I left the bloody sock on the floor of the car as planned. Nate Appleyard wasn't supposed to see it. It was there for the police to find, as soon as they got around to searching Christy's car. To add a layer of security, we arranged it so that, at first, suspicion would fall on Christy and Jeff. For that, we needed to make them look pretty guilty, hence the blood-stained sock. Otherwise, if we'd had everything pointing to Annette and Naldo Chapa's guilt right from the start, they might have been taken much more seriously when they pointed out that they were being framed, as they inevitably would have. As it was, by the time Melody's parents were charged, nobody in America suspected Jeff and Christy, and everyone suspected Annette and Naldo, not only of murder, but also of trying to frame Jeff and Christy. It's much harder to claim you're being framed when the whole country is convinced you've just been caught trying to frame someone else. Ours was a risky strategy, but it worked, and that makes me proud. I even had Jeff and Christy issue a public statement protesting the Chapa's innocence, because who would do that for a couple they themselves had framed for murder? There were other things we did that I had to fight for, against the disagreement of all my four helpers, risky things. The blood on Christy's hand and arm, for example, which, incidentally, was Christy's own and not Melody's, and the blood-stained sock moving, as if by magic, from Christy's car to Melody's school bag, where it would eventually be found by police. Everyone but me felt that these parts of the plan were inadvisable because they made Christy look not so much framed as actually guilty. Why was there blood on her arm? Did she really leave her car unlocked twice so that Annette and Naldo Chapa could first place Melody's sock in her car and then, later, take it out? That seems highly implausible. Surely it's more likely that Christy moved and hid the sock after Nate Appleyard saw it in her car. Why, asked my worried team of helpers, would I want to include anything in our plan that implicated Christy so blatantly? The answer, as I told them all at the time, and I'm happy to say that they eventually bowed to my greater knowledge, as a former prosecutor, of crime scenes, is that, in reality, the only people who look wholly and purely innocent once all the evidence is in are the most cunning of the guilty. You who are reading this statement might not know this, but please trust me. In the vicinity of a murder, the truly innocent always, without exception, have details attaching to them that cannot easily be explained away. I don't know why this should be the case. I only know that it is. I wanted Christy and Jeff to have their, yeah, but hold on, what about, questions that would always make people wonder. Every once-suspected innocent person I'd ever encountered in both of my professional lives, prosecutor and legal commentator, had such questions hanging in the air around them, even after someone else had gone to jail for the crime. And let's face it, Christy might have cut her arm that day by coincidence, and she might have left her car unlocked twice, and Annette Chapa might have decided moving the sock from the car to the bag was a more effective way to frame her friend and neighbor. All these things are possible. The fact is, the biggest danger to us all, as well as to little Melody, was that it should look as if there was no muddle, no irreconcilable details, no discrepancies, because someone had a foolproof plan. Mallory Tondini's testimony was entirely 100% genuine. Annette Choppa really did say all those terrible things in Mallory's hearing, and that's another fact that ought to speak for itself in explaining and justifying, in my opinion, what I and my fellow justice seekers did. We had to do some terrible, soul-destroying things along the way. We needed Melody's blood in substantial quantities. We needed her hair to show that she'd ingested arsenic. I won't dwell on the details. Suffice it to say that we had sound medical advice at every stage. I can't and won't reveal the source naturally. And we did everything we could to make these various ordeals as painless and tolerable for Melody as we could. And now to the plastic surgery side of things. Several commentators have asked why we waited so long. Why not do it right away and let Melody try and lead a normal life instead of keeping her hidden away in one trailer after another? The answer is a combination of reasons. We didn't want to do it too soon after the arsenic and the bloodletting. But the main thing was that we needed Melody to be old enough to understand the implications of the surgery and for her consent to it to be meaningful and valid. Was 14 still too young? Maybe. As a side note, I should also say that even when you're the great Bonnie Juno, it's not easy to find a skilled cosmetic surgeon who'll agree to take your money and keep quiet about something like this. Getting blowfly corpses and larvae from cops who owe you favors is a walk in the park by comparison. We eventually found a suitable cosmetic surgeon, again, no names, but of course we won't now be making use of that person's services. Why were we reckless enough to allow Melody to be out and about at a busy resort? First, the poor kid needed a vacation, but we probably wouldn't have risked it if it weren't for an extraordinary coincidence. Brianna Briggs had moved to Arizona to be closer to her best friend, and she'd happened to land a job at a resort that had Mrs. Lilith McNair as a regular guest. When Rihanna told me that Mrs. McNair picked a different child every year and insisted that child was Melody Choppa, I saw a chance. Where better to hide Melody? If anyone said, "Wait, isn't that Melody Choppa?" Surely the resort staff would all groan and say, "Oh, Lord, not another one. Mrs. McNair's craziness must be contagious." Everyone knows by now how we dealt with what we saw as the only possible risk, the brown mark near Melody's hairline, so I won't comment further on that, except to say that I deeply regret any hurt this part of our story has caused to cancer sufferers and their families. I am, of course, aware that cancer is a devastating illness, not merely an accessory to be used when it suits a particular agenda. I did, however, feel I had no choice in the circumstances, and hence Haley came into existence. Melody loved her holiday at the Swallowtail Resort. She swam a little and took an art class and generally had a ball. She's a lovely girl and she's strong. She'll be okay now, whatever happens. One wonderful result of the truth coming to light is that now Melody will be able to be properly reunited with Christy and Jeff Reville once they've served their sentences. The three of them can then live openly as a family if they wish to. Finally, Christy and Jeff will be able to provide Melody with the loving parenting she never got from her own parents. If our plan had succeeded, this would never have been possible. For many years, we had to limit the number of times per year that Christy and Jeff could see Melody to one or two. Those years were agony, particularly for Christy, who wrote hundreds of letters to Melody to make up for the lack of face-to-face contact. Then, more recently, we settled into a routine of once a month, but in order for these reunions to pass undetected, we had to spend large amounts of money and jump through many practical hoops. For Christy and Jeff, knowing that they will now be able, one day, to conduct their relationship with their beloved Melody quite openly is a dream come true. Given this, how can I have any regrets? I have none. Actually, that's not true. I can't help wishing that Mrs. Cara Burrows from Hertford, England, had stayed at home with her family instead of coming to Arizona when she did, for her sake, not mine. I regret that she became entangled in this. I also regret that I had to try to convince her husband that her aversion to him was so strong she'd vanished by choice and solely in order to avoid him. It didn't make me feel good about myself to say those things to a distraught man who had flown all the way from England. I console myself with the knowledge that Mrs. Burrows is happily reunited with her family now, and that's all that matters. I bear her no grudge and wish her and her loved ones all the best. I've wondered often if it might have been fate that caused Rihanna Briggs to make the stupid mistake with the hotel room number. She claims it was her guilt on account of what we'd done and the way it was messing with her mind, but I thought to myself as soon as she told me, maybe we're not supposed to get away with this, and maybe that's okay.
I told her, dial 911. You've had a report of a supposedly dead girl, a murdered girl, seen alive at your resort. So that's what you do. You call the police. Rihanna protested, but I said, it's what an innocent person would do. At the same time as I was telling Leon Reville to get Melody the hell out of there before detectives started nosing around the place, I was thinking to myself, this might be it. If the Lord wants us to be stopped, calling in the cops ought to take care of it. When it became clear to me that the FBI knew the full truth, I didn't deny it and I didn't complain. Ultimately, I care little for myself. I have tried to be the humble servant of justice and of our dear Lord, and I hope I've succeeded. My love for both remains as proud and strong as ever. Love, ultimately, is all that matters, spreading and sharing love while banishing hate. Christy and Jeff Reville love Melody with all their hearts. So much of the love in our plan came from them. The Machiavellian plotting, the plan to ride roughshod over the law of the land, that was where I came in. Me, and, at the risk of sounding vulgar, my money. Because let me tell you, you can't pull off something like this without extensive resources at your disposal. If you want to blame anyone for what we all did, blame me. Christy, Jeff, and Leon Reville and Rihanna Briggs have nothing but good inside them.
Chapter 18. October 23rd, 2017. The Clearwater Resort in Sedona is surrounded by beautiful red rocks on all sides. Boyanton Canyon, it's called, and it's stunning. In many ways, apart from the vivid redness of the landscape, it's similar here to Swallowtail. There's a main building, a network of little roads, many casitas, gleaming turquoise swimming pools, club car chauffeur service. And now me, a Melody Charper. I'm sitting on the sofa of the casita where she's staying with her new chaperone, a grey-haired, bespectacled woman named Jennifer. Melody sitting in an armchair opposite me. This must be strange for you, I say, hoping it will start a conversation. It's my second attempt. I expected when I got here that Jennifer might help with the awkward introductions phase, but she said virtually nothing. She's arranging things in the kitchen area, less than 2 meters from where Melody and I are sitting, but it's as if she's in a separate universe. I suppose the FBI must train these people to appear invisible. It's certainly strange for me. Melody nods.
Detective Pretty told me you have children, she says.
I do, yes. Jess and Ollie. Jess is about your age. They're here. I mean, not here, but at the resort. They're with their dad, probably ordering smoothies somewhere. She's watching me. It's as if she's waiting for me to say more. I'm expecting a third child, who is here, I pat my stomach.
What will you call it?
I don't know.
My favourite girl's name is Georgia.
That's a lovely name.
Agent Kirchmere says my parents don't want to see me. They say I've lied about them, that I lied in my book, so they don't want to talk to me. They refuse. Do you think that's true?
Oh, God. I was hoping the small talk might last a bit longer. Don't be a coward, Kara. She asked you a question. This is all so much worse for her than it is for you. I think you can probably trust what Agent Kirchmere tells you, I say, wondering if I'll ever again be able to place my full trust in anything or anyone. Melody nods.
I guess I don't blame them. My parents, I mean. I wrote some...
She hesitates.
I wrote some things about them.
You mean you told Christy, and Christy wrote them? I've been thinking a lot about Christy and her ghost writing of Melody's book. The parts I read were full of doubts about Christy herself, and Jeff, presumably. The kind smiles. Melody had written in several places and in various different ways that she didn't know if she could trust them or not. In places they came across as gauche and insensitive. Did Christy include those sections because Melody had expressed those sentiments to her, and it would have felt wrong to admit them, however unflattering they were? Or was it more complex than that? Was it the guilt in Christy's unconscious mind making itself known, using Melody as a mouthpiece? Or worse, most cynical possibility of all, did Christy or Bonnie Juno calculate that the best way to make it look as if Melody wrote the book herself was to have her express doubts about the person who actually wrote it? A look of confusion passes across Melody's face.
Yes, Christy wrote it all down. It's still my book, though. It's my story.
Of course. How will anyone ever be able to talk to this girl in a normal way? All I can think is that she was hidden away for 7 years, forced to collude in the most horrific lie.
If one of your children wrote bad things about you in a book, would you ever forgive them? Would you ever talk to them again?
I'd forgive my children whatever they did, and I'd always want to talk to them and have them in my life. But I'm not Annette or Naldo Charper.
And if your parents don't feel that way, they're to blame for that, Melody, not you. She nods. Because they're bad parents. Not like you. You're a good parent. I could tell the first time I saw you. I thought you were nice.
Bad parents, good parents, bad things, nice. Unsurprisingly, her vocabulary is basic. I wonder what her story, written entirely and only by her and not edited by Christy Revel, would look like.
Christy says her and Jeff have always been my parents, if that word means the people who look out for you, says Melody. Do you think that's true?
Well, I suppose. A loud hissing noise starts up, swallowing the rest of my sentence and making me jump. It's Jennifer in the kitchen. She's turned on a tap. Melody leans forward, wide-eyed.
I don't remember, she whispers.
What do you mean? What don't you remember?
The things Christy wrote in the book that happened to me. I don't remember them.
My breath stops in my throat. I feel dizzy. The eyes I'm looking at are ones I've not seen before. Two dark tunnels of terror. The girl who was here 5 seconds ago is gone. This Melody is a different person. You don't remember any of them? I ask her. She shakes her head, then glances over at Jennifer. Is she waiting for her to turn, or for the tap to go off? I think so. I think she's worked out that, for as long as the water's running, we won't be overheard.
Christy said I told her about the things when I was little, but I just don't remember. Do you think that's bad? And I pretended I did because Jeff said I did too? And then I said I did, to the other kind smiles, to Bonnie. She believed it because I helped to make it seem true. That's bad that I did that.
She's speaking quickly, to say as much as she can while the tap's still gushing.
So, when your mother cut up Rosa the Bear, and when she talked you into pretending Woody was your boyfriend, you don't remember those two things happening?
The tap goes off. Jennifer turns around.
Okay, I've finished in the kitchen, she says brightly. Cara, would you like a drink? Coffee?
No, thanks, Melody. Do you... I can't ask the question. Not now, we've got an audience. I've said too much already. Stupid.
What's the matter?
Jennifer asks in a different, more alert voice.
Melody? Is something wrong?
No, thanks, Jennifer. I'm fine.
She's a better actor than I am. A lot better. But this is crazy. Jennifer's on our side. She's on Melody's side. There's no reason to hide this from her.
Listen, I start to say.
Yes? Melody looks straight at me, but it's not the same girl who spoke so urgently a moment ago. This is official Melody. Public Melody.
I remember all the things you just said. Rosa and Woody.
But you told me you didn't. Panic rises inside me, all the way up to my throat. It's my word against hers. Hers and Christy and Jeff Revels. The only loving parent she's ever likely to have.
You can tell Jennifer, Melody. Everyone's on your side. Me, Jennifer, the police.
Okay, I'm going to need to know what this is about.
Jennifer's moving briskly toward us, as if we're a fight in a bar that needs breaking up.
It's nothing, says Melody calmly. I do remember Kara.
Really?
She doesn't seem scared anymore.
I remember all of it.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Keep Her Safe, a novel by Sophie Hannah. Performed by Fiona Hardingham, Caitlin Kelly, and Nicole Poole. This program was produced by Dion Audio. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2017 by Sophie Hannah. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.